Wednesday, the 21st, during lecture, is when we will have our extra time for the exam. During lecture. That means, yes, you have to come to lecture, anyone that's listening to this right now. So if you have friends that are not here, or maybe if they're not friends, but there's still people that are not here, give them the courtesy of letting them know that Wednesday at 10:30, not 10:32, not 10:35, whoever is about to walk in would be the perfect timing right now. So, and I don't know how many minutes yet because I just got the exams this morning, so I hadn't even flipped through them yet, but there will be time on Wednesday. Now, we do need to lecture today, and obviously I'm not going to be talking about anything that's still on the exam, and those of you who haven't figured this out quite yet, part of the reason you hadn't gotten quiz 3 back yet, you all discovered this yet? The quiz 3 questions you had went on the other section's exam, and the quiz 3 they had, their question was on your exam. That's right. Wow, I can't believe you hadn't figured that out yet. Okay. So that's why you hadn't gotten the quiz 3s back yet, because I had that planned all along. So, what I would like to talk about today, though, is the Diels-Alder reaction. Because we do need to move on with lecture. Wow, I almost wrote the wrong year there. Well, because 319, I don't write that that often. It's usually when I'm filling out a form of some kinds. All right, Diels-Alder. The Diels-Alder reaction is kind of in the same class of the con-rotatory and dis-rotatory reactions that we learned last week. It's another form of paracyclic reaction, which means there is a cyclic mechanism involved, but unlike the one that we saw last week, instead of it just being one molecule that is closing up to become cyclic, there are two molecules involved in this case. And this is a specific reaction between a diene, so it's some kind of conjugated system, and what's often called a dienophile, something that likes to react with dienes. Good morning. Now, one of the simplest forms of Diels-Alder reaction involves the molecule cyclopentadiene. And we'll discuss in a moment why this particular molecule is fairly reactive towards the Diels-Alder reaction. Reactive enough that, in fact, when you buy the compound, it usually comes in the form of a dimer. And here's an example mechanism. We can imagine that one of the double bonds of the diene reacts with the other molecule, which reacts back with the other end of the diene, which then pushes that double bond over to where the first double bond in the diene had been. So again, a cyclic style of mechanism. The product that results is a type of product that we haven't really seen in problems before, a bicyclic compound. So you'll need a little bit of practice drawing these types of structures. So if you notice the way I drew it, I drew the bottom part of the structure, which isn't exactly a cyclohexane, but reminiscent of one. So draw that first before you draw the little bridgehead carbon up top. Actually, you had seen a compound like this, only in the discussion, though, of bridgehead positions. So now we're actually making compounds that have that form of structure. Need to draw a little bit more in, haven't completed it yet. Because we started with two double bonds in the diene, but you're going to end up with just one in the product. So, in fact, let me circle to show you which portion corresponds to which initial ring. And then we do only have one of the double bonds that reacted in the other molecule of cyclopentadiene, so we have one more double bond left over in that portion of the molecule as well. So let me give you the term for this again. This is a dimer, which is when two of the same atom or molecule combine to form a larger structure. Some of you might have had related terms like oligomer. Those of you in bio classes might have heard that term to refer to when a few units are put together, strung together to make a larger molecule. Oligo means by a few. So the other place you might have heard that term is oligarchy. Those of you who have ever taken any kind of government class means rule by a few. Or you might have heard the more common term still, polymer, which means when you bring a bunch of different units, the same type of units together to make a larger molecule. So dimer just happens to mean two. Why does this reaction occur? We'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk first a little bit about mechanics, because this is a particularly good reaction. Why? Because of the way that the diene has its structure locked into a particular configuration. So let's imagine we had a linear molecule like butadiene. Now let me ask you, these two versions of butadiene I just wrote, are they different molecules? They're the same molecule, that's right. What is the only difference between these two? Now wait a minute. The left-hand molecule, is either of those double bonds classifiable as cis or trans? And in the second molecule, is either of those double bonds classifiable as cis or trans? But, no, they're not. Because if you look at it, each of the double bonds in those compounds only has one substituent. You can't have cis and trans if the double bond itself only has one substituent. What you're accidentally looking at is what the single bond looks like, because in the first way that I drew it, it has the appearance of being trans, even though it's a single bond, and remember that single bonds can rotate, but it does turn out that the relative configuration of one double bond to the other is important for Diels-Alder reactions, because imagine this, we've got the diene, imagine the front of this monitor is the alkene that the diene is going to react with, so you could have the two arms of the diene that almost as if it sits down on that double bond of the alkene that's going to react with it, the dienophile that's going to react with it. And you can imagine if you've got p orbitals from the diene and you've got p orbitals from that dienophile, that when those p orbitals have a head-to-head overlap, you form a sigma bond, just like we had in those paracyclic reactions. These are rotamers, the difference between the two of them, right? So single bonds can actually rotate. But yes, the first one is what's called pseudo-trans, which for whatever reason is abbreviated S-trans. And then we have pseudo-cis or S-cis. And what the point I was making when the door opened there, that's right, is if you had this diene that can sit down and react with a dienophile and form the new sigma bonds, then it matters that the two ends of diene can actually connect to that dienophile. If you've got one double bond pointed one way and the other one trans and pointing the opposite way, then it can't get around to react with the dienophile. So a diene must be in the pseudo-cis configuration in order for a Diels-Alder reaction to be successful. So in the case of this butadiene, it is reactive, but not as much so as the cyclopentadiene, because here we do have the possibility of making rotamers. The single bond can rotate, and so anytime it rotates and makes the trans configuration, that temporarily slows the reaction down because it has to wait for that bond to rotate again. But if you have something that's locked into the cis configuration, like cyclopentadiene, then there is no steric factor in the sense that you don't have to wait for the bonds to get in the right orientation. So it makes it a much more reactive diene. Of course, the opposite possibility can occur. So here is a diene. It is conjugated, if you look carefully at the position of one double bond to the other. But there's no way this can ever become pseudo-cis. Permanently locked into pseudo-trans, so it cannot undergo Diels-Alder. Now, another aspect that we'll get into next lecture is the electron withdrawing character of most of either the dienes or dienophiles. Because what you need, really, for the reaction to be successful is something that's got some extra electron density that can be provided and something that is lacking electron density to encourage the other molecule to attack it. But the other aspect I want to get into today is geometry, because when you have a Diels-Alder reaction, there are often two different products that will form. And so let me show you a very specific example of a Diels-Alder reaction. If we have something like this, which I forget if this is malic or malic and a maleic anhydride, but this is a conjugated system, but it will be just the alkene portion of this that reacts. And so we could throw something like cyclopentadiene at that and have a Diels-Alder reaction, which, just a reminder of the mechanism, it is one of these cyclic style mechanisms where one double bond attacks the next. Then here are the two products that result. One of the products looks as if the new bonds that were formed not from one molecule to the next, but the position of the carbonyls that I'm getting at. The bonds connecting to those look like they are the equivalent of axial positions. The other possibility is to end up with a structure where it looks like those bonds are pointed more as if they were in the equatorial position. Now, this is not a chair form of cyclohexane, so it's not really quite proper to be using those terms axial and equatorial, but close enough where they make sense enough that that's why I'm using them. Instead of using these terms axial and equatorial, we notice that one of the forms of the molecule, if you have an imagination, it looks a little bit more like it's pointed towards the interior of the molecule, where the other one, this group that was added in, is pointed more towards the exterior of the molecule. So instead, we refer to these as the endo versus the exo forms. Now, in terms of sterics, if we could call these axial and equatorial hydrogens or positions, which one should be more thermodynamically stable, would you guess? The endo or the exo? Well, if it was a cyclohexane ring, we had substituents. Do substituents prefer, in terms of sterics, to go axial equatorial? Equatorial, remember? Because if you have something axial, you have that diaxial strain that's possible. So to avoid sterics, exoform should be the one that's more favorable. But there are some Diels-Alder reactions where it turns out that due to electronics, due to the way that orbitals interact, that you get preference for the endoform. And that's what I would like to cover with the remaining amount of lecture time that we have today. Why is it that something might prefer the sterically more hindered endoform? Now, in order to explain why, for example, in the specific reaction, the endoform is more preferred, to figure that out, we have to look at the molecular orbitals. And we have two systems we have to look at molecular orbitals of, because we have a 6p orbital molecule, the anhydride, that's reacting with a 4p orbital molecule, the butadiene. Now, what kind of reaction is going to go on here? Remember that for those conrotatory and disrotatory reactions, that's where we got our introduction to frontier orbital theory. The idea that there are these electrons in the highest occupied molecular orbital that are going to be the electrons that participate in the reaction. And they have to go somewhere. They want to go to the lowest energy spot available, which is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. So electrons from the HOMO of one of those molecules is going to go to the LUMO of the other. And it turns out it doesn't matter which one we consider being the attacking molecule. We're going to get the same prediction for both of them. But the one thing I'll tell you is that this particular reaction, these types of Diels-Alder reactions that we have a diene and a monoene reacting, they occur thermally. Why do I have to worry about whether something happens thermally or through light?
Does that matter, kinetics versus thermodynamics?
Nope. Good guess. Not photoelectric effect, but the idea that if we had light, we could have something in its excited state. Because remember, the highest occupied molecular orbital changes depending on whether you are in the ground or excited states. So now when we did the conrotatory disrotatory reactions last week, I wrote out all six of those orbitals for a six orbital system, did I not?
Yes.
We don't really need to write all of those out again, because what really just matters is which one is the HOMO, which one is the LUMO. But if you remember, for a six orbital system, there are going to be six molecular orbitals. And if we have six pi electrons, like we do, and this is the ground state, is someone going to take me to the hospital once I have insular shock? So, we have the ground state, so this one is the orbital that we care about. Now look at the four orbital system, where we have four pi electrons, and still we're going to be in the ground state. So it is the lower of the two antibody orbitals that is going to be the LUMO. So the theory is the reaction happens by these higher energy electrons jumping into the lowest available orbital. So just like we did for those other paracyclic reactions, let's look at the shape of the molecular orbital itself and see if there is the proper phase overlap that occurs between orbitals. So what we need then is to write out the full full orbital structure for the HOMO of the 6 orbital system and the LUMO for the 4 orbital system. Now, in the 6 orbital system, how many nodes are there in the lowest energy orbital?
Zero.
And how many in the first orbital above that?
One.
And how many of the one above that?
One.
Two. So if we have 2 nodes and they have to symmetrically break up the molecule, we know that the orbital we need is this one. So again, remember, for linear systems, ground state always has 0 nodes, and every orbital above has 1 additional node in it. And so instead of drawing all 6 different molecular orbitals, because we don't need all 6 of them, we only need 1, I just used a little logic. I said, oh, okay, we need the 3rd molecular orbital, the 3rd one up, which means it has 2 nodes. So I could jump to that drawing. We do the same thing with the other molecule. How many nodes are going to be in the LUMO of the 4 orbital system? 2, because again, 0, 1, and 2 nodes. So it's going to look like this. Now, let's look at an interaction between these 2 molecules. So here is the diene portion. And here is the anhydride portion. And let's fill in the orbital diagram. And we can see that we have the correct phase between the specific portions of the orbital that are going to react, that are going to be involved in this Diels-Alder reaction. So if you look back at the mechanism, remember that the carbonyls don't get involved, and it's one end or the other of the diene that gets involved. And so those 2 ends have the correct phase overlap. But if you notice the way that the diene is currently, not the diene, the anhydride is currently pointed, this is going to end up producing the exo product. Which so far doesn't mean anything. Just for the moment, know that yes, we do have correct orbital overlap. Which justifies why this reaction can occur with heat. But what if we take the anhydride and just turn it upside down? Take the oxygen here and just physically turn the molecule upside down. Could that potentially change the reaction at all? Well, let's see. Oh. Doug. Sorry. Just copying, not drawing the new case. Yes. Oh, sorry. Oh, good grief. One more try. Third time's the charm, right? Let me start with this first, because this is what I'm grappling with. How to write this so it's legible. There we go. And then if I put it here. I think that's as good as I'm going to get it. No. Ugh. On the exam? No, I'm just demonstrating why it is that you need to practice this problem before you get to the exam so you don't do the same darn thing, right? Learn from my mistakes. Do what I say, not what I do. You will see why I'm trying to be this careful momentarily, because now that I've managed to successfully draw it, let's put the orbitals back in. And we still have the same kind of correct orbital overlap that's going to occur. And you'll see why I'm doing this with curvy lines in just a moment. Because this is the primary orbital overlap. Gesundheit. But notice that there's another portion of the molecule where the two orbitals can interact with the correct phase. They don't end up forming bonds, but because that is a possible favorable interaction, that's energetically more favorable. And so this product, even though it ends up more sterically hindered, ends up being the one formed in larger proportion because there's this additional electronic interaction. So due to the greater extent of orbital interaction, the endoform is produced in greater quantity. Even though the product has more steric hindrance, or steric interaction, than the exoform. So let me briefly summarize what we've done with the reaction, the deals all the reaction day. We saw a classic example of cyclopentadiene dimerizing, And just to retell that story again, the cyclopentadiene is locked into correct configuration for a Diels-Alder reaction, which is why the reaction happens easily, even effectively, at room temperature. So when you buy cyclopentadiene, you have to do this process called cracking it, which is to heat it enough to de-dimerize it. So that was just our simple example of a Diels-Alder reaction, which led to that discussion of pseudocis and pseudotrans. And the whole point there is if the ends of the diene are too far away from each other, they can't react with an alkene, and so no Diels-Alder reaction occurs. Then commented the Diels-Alder reactions with dienes and monoenes. So there are other types of what are called cycloadditions. But for this specific kind, which you could also call it a 4-2 cycloaddition, occurs thermally, and the way that we can argue why it should occur thermally is to write this type of orbital interaction diagram. And again, I first identified which are the orbitals that are going to interact. Has to be the HOMO from one, the LUMO from another. And if you were to redo this problem and flop which one you choose, in this case, I chose the LUMO for the diene, and then I chose the HOMO for that conjugated alkene. I could have flipped it around and chose the LUMO for one and the HOMO on the other. It turns out the orbital symmetry will be exactly the same. So for answering the question, you can choose either possibility. But it has to be one of those two possibilities, because it's going to be the highest energy electrons that react, and it's going to be the lowest energy orbital that they can access that they're going to go into. From there, rather than drawing all of the orbitals out, I chose just to draw the one that corresponded to those frontier orbitals, the one that we care about. And that's what the diagram on the right is, to show how they interact. The one warning I got to give you for this is if you write these two orbitals independently of each other, the way I did, I just said, okay, two nodes, so I'll draw it like this, two nodes, so I'll draw it like this. For either of these diagrams, if I flipped which I shaded in and left unshaded the p orbitals individually, if I flipped all of them, does it change the orbital? Another way of saying it is, does the green represent plus or minus of the wave function? Don't know, and it doesn't matter. It just matters that the phase changes. So from one molecule to another, it's all right if I had to do the following. To make this answer work, if I had to flop around the green and white, but I did it for all of them, then that's an acceptable thing to do. And it's because it's arbitrary how we shade it, as long as there is the right overall phase to the orbital. I better just write that note in there. Let me make that a separate note below. Well, okay, let me finish talking about this diagram before I move on to why did we have to do the other one. So this diagram, remember, that in the mechanism, it's a cyclic mechanism where one end of the diene bumps into the other, which bumps into the alkene, which bumps back into where you started. And this is exactly that situation I was talking about, where if you imagine that the two ends of the diene sit down on top of that alkene, then you're going to form new sigma bonds by head-to-head overlap. Now, they don't look head-to-head, but that's because I've drawn one molecule off to the side so that I could draw it in a way that you could read it. But imagine that really they're just coming down like this. So if you form new sigma bonds here, there used to be pi bonds up above here, but they both have to break in order for the sigma bond to form. But we have the two pi bonds left over, or the two p orbitals left over. We can imagine a new pi bond forming there, which if we scoot this diagram down and look at the exoform, that's exactly what we had. So there's the new pi bond that's formed. Here's where those two interactions occurred, and here's the bottom part of that conjugated alkene that reacted with the two carbonyls. Compare that, look as I bring it up, to the orbital picture. You can see that really it's describing the same thing. The one thing that's kind of left out in this drawing is this little point which ends up getting pushed up by the two new bonds forming. The reason I did that whole diagram one more time is because I then said, well, what if this orbital, or what if this molecule had been upside down to begin with? Now, in non-conjugated systems, we wouldn't have the carbonyls to worry about, and so there wouldn't be the secondary orbital effect. But we do have the secondary orbital effect in a molecule like this. And what we can see is that other than the main bonding interaction, other than this main bonding interaction, we have this, I'm not going to call it non-bonding, it doesn't produce bonds, the other interaction, but it's favorable. And if it's favorable because the orbitals match phase, that's going to reduce the energy of the transition state. Because once you make the product, you don't have that orbital interaction anymore. But because it's favorable before the reaction occurs, it lowers the activation energy, makes the reaction faster, makes it the more likely product. And that is pretty much, other than talking about electron donating versus withdrawing, which I would like to handle that a different day. This is the whole Diels-Alder topic. So, on Wednesday, when we do our review for the lab quiz, we will talk about the lab aspects of this Diels-Alder reaction. But are there any questions about it? Yes?
Could you please explain again how we graph the endo and exo?
What the endo and exo forms look like? Okay, so do you remember the axial and equatorial positions on a cyclohexane ring? So look at the endoform. See how this is pointed straight up and down, the substituents that I've written on what we could call the main ring? So because they're straight up and down, that's as if they were axial positions, if that was a cyclohexane ring. And so they're called endo because if you built a model, then more than not, they're pointed towards the molecule. Now, not really. They're not pointed up into the interior. It's more that if you look at the exoform, those substituents really are pointed away from the molecule. Because they're pointed away, they avoid steric interaction, so that's normally the favorable form.
And how do you get, how many double bonds do you have?
On the product? There's always one less double bond on each molecule that you start with. So if you notice, the very first example I did had a diene, and it loses one of the double bonds, and it actually shifts over position as well. And then the other molecule happened to be a diene, and it lost one of its double bonds in addition. So both of the molecules each lose a double bond. And then on the diene, the positions move over. So maybe just for practice to know that we can draw the molecules, the product right, ignoring whether you're forming the endo or exo product, draw the product of this reaction. And I'll just tell you that it is the alkene portion of that first molecule that reacts. No, right now. Pop quiz. Just for you, though. Can we what?
When you come back from this medical, will you have pop quiz for next?
There are all kinds of things that the next class might get the joy to experience. I'll get a new haircut, a new hair color. Maybe, you know, shave it all off and I'll come in some big biker leather outfit the first day. And I'll talk in a low voice like this and I'll scare the crap out of people the first day. And then I'll just do it every day that whole year. They'll be like, his explanations are so great. We love his lectures, but oh my goodness, why did we sign up for him? Are you telling me again that I don't work out enough? Wow. The gym is that way. Do we have an answer yet? I'm just buying us time so you can all answer the question. All right, the answer is this. Notice that the bridge now has two carbons in it because there were two extra carbons, you could say, in the original molecule. Let me put numbers around all these positions. That might help a little bit too. And these are not nomenclature numbers necessarily, just random numbers to help assign position. So notice that between 2 and 3, that used to be the bridging single bond between the two different double bonds. And that's where the new double bond's going to open up. Because if you look at the reaction mechanism, regardless of which way you push electrons, one way or another, the bond gets formed between positions 2 and 3. Now, the other molecule used to be an alkene. Once it reacts, it's no longer an alkene. But you still do have that nitrile that's hanging off of it. So this is one product. Of course, you could also have its enantiomer. Oh, yes. If you put the CN on the other position, because those would be mirror image molecules, which means they're enantiomers. Of course, you could also have the two diastereomers, because I've failed to show whether this is endo or exo. And if I made it endo versus exo, that makes the diastereomer of that molecule. Would you like me to write out the four products possible then? Would you like me to confirm your fears that I might ask a stereochemistry question? Nice would be making sure that you're prepared for your transfer class. Is there too much sugar in these cakes? Am I going to have an out-of-control lab 2 in lab? usually lab 1, once lab 1's done, I'm on the way to lecture. It's like, oh, thank goodness, I can relax for the day. Because you all come with all that caffeine, I have to watch out for you. But the other group, they're after the lunch, and so they have the sugar high, or you know when those people are trying to sneak their lunch either during lab or stepping out a little quickly during the lab. So section 2, it's kind of like, so I don't get as worried about them usually. Oh my gosh, but we're out of time. See what you did? You made me talk too much. So I guess we're just going to end with the deals, all the reaction here. And Wednesday, we're going to start reviewing for the finals.